This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, The Case of Charles Dexter Ward by H.P. Lovecraft. Copyright 1941 by Weird Tales, 1943 by August Derleth and Donald Wandry. Narrated by David Palmer. This book contains 127 pages on 4 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player and fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Annotation. Driven by the spirit of an evil ancestor, a young man delves into the art of black magic and resurrects the darkest evil from beyond the grave. Other books by H.P. Lovecraft. At the Mountains of Madness and Other Tales of Terror, The Tomb and Other Tales, The Lurking Fear, The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, The Doom That Came to Sarnath. Chapter 1. A Result and a Prologue. From a private hospital for the insane near Providence, Rhode Island, there recently disappeared an exceedingly singular person. He bore the name of Charles Dexter Ward, and was placed under restraint, most reluctantly, by the grieving father, who had watched his aberration grow from a mere eccentricity to a dark mania, involving both a possibility of murderous tendencies and a peculiar change in the apparent contents of his mind. Doctors confessed themselves quite baffled by his case, since it presented oddities of a general physiological as well as psychological character. In the first place, the patient seemed oddly older than his 26 years would warrant. Mental disturbance, it is true, will age one rapidly, but the face of this young man had taken on a subtle cast which only the very aged normally acquire. In the second place, his organic processes showed a certain queerness of proportion, which nothing in medical experience can parallel. Respiration and heart action had a baffling lack of symmetry. The voice was lost, so that no sounds above a whisper were possible. Digestion was incredibly prolonged and minimized, and neural reactions to standard stimuli bore no relation to anything heretofore recorded, either normal or pathological. The skin had a morbid chill and dryness, and the cellular structure of the tissue seemed exaggeratedly coarse and loosely knit. Even a large olive birthmark on his right hip had disappeared, while there had formed on his chest a very peculiar mole, or blackish spot, of which no trace existed before. In general, all physicians agree that in Ward the processes of metabolism had become retarded to a degree beyond precedent. Psychologically, too, Charles Ward was unique. His madness held no affinity to any sort recorded in even the latest and most exhaustive of treatises, and was enjoined to be a mental force which would have made him a genius or a leader had it not been twisted into strange and grotesque forms. Dr. Willett, who was Ward's family physician, affirms that the patient's gross mental capacity, as gauged by his response to matters outside the sphere of his insanity, had actually increased since the seizure. Ward, it is true, was always a scholar and an antiquarian, but even his most brilliant early work did not show the prodigious grasp and insight displayed during his examinations by the alienists. It was indeed a difficult matter to obtain a legal commitment to the hospital, so powerful and lucid did the youth's mind seem. And only on the evidence of others, and on the strength of many abnormal gaps in his stock of information, as distinguished from his intelligence, was he finally placed in confinement. To the very moment of his vanishment, he was an omnivorous reader, and as great a conversationalist as his poor voice permitted. And shrewd observers, failing to foresee his escape, freely predicted that he would not be long in gaining his discharge from custody. Only Dr. Willett, who had brought Charles Ward into the world and watched his growth of body and mind ever since, seemed frightened at the thought of this future freedom. He had had a terrible experience and had made a terrible discovery, which he dared not reveal to his skeptical colleagues. Willett, indeed, presents a minor mystery, all his own, in his connection with the case. He was the last to see the patient before his flight, and emerged from that final conversation in a state of mixed horror and relief, which several recalled when Ward's escape became known 3 hours later. That escape itself is one of the unsolved wonders of Dr. Waite's hospital. A window open above a sheer drop of 60 feet would hardly explain it. Yet after that talk with Willett, the youth was undeniably gone. Willett himself has no public explanations to offer, though he seems strangely easier in mind than before the escape. Many indeed feel that he would like to say more if he thought any considerable number would believe him. He had found Ward in his room, but shortly after his departure, the attendants knocked in vain. When they opened the door, the patient was not there, and all they found was the opened window, with a chill April breeze blowing in a cloud of fine bluish-gray dust that almost choked them. True, the dogs howled some time before, but that was while Willett was still present, and they had caught nothing and shown no disturbance later on. Ward's father was told at once over the telephone, but he seemed more saddened than surprised. By the time Dr. Waite called in person, Dr. Willett had been talking with him, and both disavowed any knowledge or complicity in the escape. Only from certain closely confidential friends of Willett and the senior ward have any clues been gained, and even these are too wildly fantastic for general credence. The one fact which remains is that up to the present time no trace of the missing madman has been unearthed. Charles Ward was an antiquarian from infancy, no doubt gaining his taste from the venerable town around him, and from the relics of the past which filled every corner of his parents' old mansion in Prospect Street, on the crest of the hill. With the years his devotion to ancient things increased, so that history, genealogy, and the study of colonial architecture, furniture, and craftsmanship at length crowded everything else from his sphere of interests. These tastes are important to remember in considering his madness, for although they do not form its absolute nucleus, they play a prominent part in its superficial form. The gaps of information which the alienists noticed were all related to modern matters and were invariably offset by a correspondingly excessive, though outwardly concealed, knowledge of bygone matters, as brought out by adroit questioning, so that one would have fancied the patient literally transferred to a former age through some obscure sort of auto-hypnosis. The odd thing was that Ward seemed no longer interested in the antiquaries he knew so well. He had, it appears, lost his regard for them through sheer familiarity, and all his final efforts were obviously bent toward mastering those common facts of the modern world which had been so totally and unmistakably expunged from his brain. That this wholesale deletion had occurred, he did his best to hide, but it was clear to all who watched him that his whole program of reading and conversation was determined by a frantic wish to imbibe such knowledge of his own life and of the ordinary practical and cultural background of the 20th century as ought to have been his by virtue of his birth in 1902 and his education in the schools of our own time. Alienists are now wondering how, in view of his wholly impaired stock of data, the escaped patient manages to cope with the complicated world of today, the dominant opinion being that he is lying low in some humble and unexacting position till his stock of modern information can be brought up to the normal. The beginning of Ward's madness is a matter of dispute among alienists. Dr. Lyman, the eminent Boston authority, places it in 1919 or 1920, during the boy's last year at the Moses Brown School, where he suddenly turned from the study of the past to the study of the occult, and refused to qualify for college on the ground that he had individual researches of much greater importance to make. This is certainly brought out by Ward's altered habits at the time, especially by his continual search through town records and among old burying grounds, for a certain grave dug in 1771, the grave of an ancestor named Joseph Kirwan, some of whose papers he professed to have found behind the paneling of a very old house in Olney Court on Stamper's Hill, which Kirwan was known to have occupied. It is, broadly speaking, undeniable that the winter of 1919-20 saw a great change in Ward, whereby he abruptly stopped his general antiquarian pursuits and embarked on a desperate delving into occult subjects, both at home and abroad, varied only by this strangely persistent search for his forefather's grave. From this opinion, however, Dr. Willett substantially dissents, basing his verdict on his close and continuous knowledge of the patient, and on certain frightful investigations and discoveries which he made toward the last. Those investigations and discoveries have left their mark upon him, so that his voice trembles when he tells them, and his hand trembles when he tries to write of them. Willett admits that the change of 1919-20 would ordinarily appear to mark the beginning of a progressive decadence which culminated in the horrible, sad, uncanny alienation of 1928, but believes from personal observation that a finer distinction must be made. Granting freely that the boy was always ill-balanced temperamentally, and prone to be unduly susceptible and enthusiastic in his responses to phenomena around him, he refuses to concede that the early alteration marked the actual passage from sanity to madness, crediting instead Ward's own statement that he had discovered or rediscovered something whose effect on human thought was likely to be marvelous and profound. The true madness, he is certain, came with a later change, after the Kirwan portrait and the ancient papers had been unearthed, after a trip to strange foreign places had been made, and some terrible invocations chanted under strange and secret circumstances, after certain answers to these invocations had been plainly indicated, and a frantic letter penned under agonizing and inexplicable conditions, after the wave of vampirism and the ominous Pawtuxet gossip, and after the patient's memory commenced to exclude contemporary images, whilst his voice failed and his physical aspect underwent the subtle modification so many subsequently noticed. It was only about this time, Willett points out with much acuteness, that the nightmare qualities became indubitably linked with Ward, and the doctor feels shudderingly sure that enough solid evidence exists to sustain the youth's claim regarding his crucial discovery. In the first place, two workmen of high intelligence saw Joseph Kirwan's ancient papers found. Secondly, the boy once showed him those papers and a page of the Kirwan diary, and each of the documents had every appearance of genuineness. The hole where Ward claimed to have found them is a visible reality, and Willett had a very convincing final glimpse of them in surroundings which can scarcely be believed and can never perhaps be proved. Then there were the mysteries and coincidences of the Orne and Hutchinson letters, and the problem of the Kirwan penmanship, and of what the detectives brought to light about Dr. Allen. These things and the terrible message in medieval minuscules found in Willett's pocket when he gained consciousness after his shocking experience. And most conclusive of all, there are the two hideous results which the doctor obtained from a certain pair of formulae during his final investigations, results which virtually proved the authenticity of the papers and of their monstrous implications at the same time that those papers were borne forever from human knowledge. One must look back at Charles Ward's earlier life as at something belonging as much to the past as the antiquities he loved so keenly. In the autumn of 1918, and with a considerable show of zest in the military training of the period, he had begun his junior year at the Moses Brown School, which lies very near his home. The old main building, erected in 1819, had always charmed his youthful antiquarian sense, and the spacious park in which the academy is set appealed to his eye for landscape. His social activities were few, and his hours were spent mainly at home, in rambling walks, in his classes and drills, and in pursuit of antiquarian and genealogical data at the City Hall, the State House, the Public Library, the Athenaeum, the Historical Society, the John Carter Brown and John Hay Libraries of Brown University, and the newly opened Shipley Library in Benefit Street. One may picture him yet as he was in those days. Tall, slim, and blonde, with studious eyes and a slight stoop, dressed somewhat carelessly, and giving a dominant impression of harmless awkwardness rather than attractiveness. His walks were always adventures in antiquity, during which he managed to recapture from the myriad relics of a glamorous old city a vivid and connected picture of the centuries before. His home was a great Georgian mansion atop the well-nigh precipitous hill that rises just east of the river, and from the rear windows of its rambling wings he could look dizzily out over all the clustered spires, domes, roofs, and skyscraper summits of the lower town to the purple hills of the countryside beyond. Here he was born, and from the lovely classic porch of the double-bayed brick facade, his nurse had first wheeled him in his carriage, past the little white farmhouse of 200 years before that the town had long overtaken, and on toward the stately colleges along the stately, sumptuous street, whose old square brick mansions and smaller wooden houses with narrow, heavy-columned Doric porches dreamed solid and exclusive amidst their generous yards and gardens. He had been wheeled, too, along sleepy Congdon Street, one tier lower down on the steep hill, and with all its eastern houses on high terraces. The small wooden houses averaged a greater age here, for it was up this hill that the growing town had climbed, and in these rides he had imbibed something of the color of a quaint colonial village. The nurse used to stop and sit on the benches of Prospect Terrace to chat with policemen. And one of the child's first memories was of the great westward sea of hazy roofs and domes and steeples and far hills which he saw one winter afternoon from that great railed embankment, all violet and mystic against a fevered apocalyptic sunset of reds and golds and purples and curious greens. The vast marble dome of the State House stood out in massive silhouette, its crowning statue haloed fantastically by a break in one of the tinted stratus clouds that barred the flaming sky. When he was larger, his famous walks began, first with his impatiently dragged nurse, and then alone in dreamy meditation. Farther and farther down that almost perpendicular hill he would venture, each time reaching older and quainter levels of the ancient city. He would hesitate gingerly down vertical Jenks Street, with its back walls and colonial gables, to the shady Benefit Street corner, where before him was a wooden antique with an Ionic pilastered pair of doorways, and beside him a prehistoric gambrel roofer, with a bit of primal farmyard remaining, and the great Judge Durfee house with its fallen vestiges of Georgian grandeur. It was getting to be a slum here, but the Titan elms cast a restoring shadow over the place, and the boy used to stroll south past the long lines of pre-revolutionary homes with their great central chimneys and classic portals. On the eastern side, they were set high over basements with railed double flights of stone steps, and the young Charles could picture them as they were when the street was new, and red heels and periwigs set off the painted pediments, whose signs of wear were now becoming so visible. Westward, the hill dropped almost as steeply as above, down to the old town street that the founders had laid out at the river's edge in 1636. Here ran innumerable little lanes with leaning, huddled houses of immense antiquity, and fascinated though he was, it was long before he dared to thread their archaic verticality for fear they would turn out to be a dream or a gateway to unknown terrors. He found it much less formidable to continue along Benefit Street, past the iron fence of St. John's hidden churchyard, and the rear of the 1761 Colony House, and the mouldering bulk of the Golden Ball Inn, where Washington stopped. At Meeting Street, the successive Jail Lane and King Street of other periods, He would look upward to the east and see the arched flight of steps to which the highway had to resort in climbing the slope, and downward to the west, glimpsing the old brick colonial schoolhouse that smiles across the road at the ancient sign of Shakespeare's head, where the Providence Gazette and Country Journal was printed before the Revolution. Then came the exquisite First Baptist Church of 1775, luxurious with its matchless Gibbs steeple and the Georgian roofs and cupolas hovering by. Here, and to the southward, the neighborhood became better, flowering at last into a marvelous group of early mansions. But still the little ancient lanes led off down the precipice to the west, spectral in their many-peaked archaism and dipping to a riot of iridescent decay where the wicked old waterfront recalls its proud East India days amidst polyglot vice and squalor, rotting wharves and blear-eyed ship chandleries, and such surviving alley names as packet, bullion, gold, silver, coin, doubloon, sovereign, guilder, dollar, dime, and cent. Sometimes, as he grew taller and more adventurous, young Ward would venture down into this maelstrom of tottering houses, broken transoms, bubbling steps, twisted balustrades, swarthy faces, and nameless odors, winding from South Main to South Water, searching out the docks where the bay and sound steamers still touched, and returning northward at this lower level past the steep-roofed 1816 warehouses and the broad square at the Great Bridge. Here the 1773 market house still stands firm on its ancient arches. In that square he would pause to drink in the bewildering beauty of the old town as it rises on the eastward bluff, decked with its Georgian spires and crowned by the vast new Christian Science dome as London is crowned by St. Paul's. He liked mostly to reach this point in the late afternoon, when the slanting sunlight touches the market house and the ancient hill roofs and belfries with gold, and throws magic around the dreaming wharves where Providence Indiaman used to ride at anchor. After a long look, he would grow almost dizzy with a poet's love for the sight, and then he would scale the slope homeward in the dusk, past the old white church, and up the narrow precipitous ways where yellow gleams would begin to peep out in small paned windows, and through fanlights set high over double flights of steps with curious wrought-iron railings. At other times, and in later years, he would seek for vivid contrasts, spending half a walk in the crumbling colonial regions northwest of his home, where the hill drops to the lower eminence of Stamper's Hill, with its ghetto and Negro quarter clustering round the place where the Boston stagecoach used to start before the Revolution, and the other half in the gracious southernly realm about George, Benevolent Power, and Williams Streets, where the old slope holds unchanged, the fine estates and bits of walled garden and steep green lane in which so many fragrant memories linger. These rambles, together with the diligent studies which accompanied them, certainly account for a large amount of the antiquarian lore which at last crowded the modern world from Charles Ward's mind, and illustrates the mental soil upon which fell, in that fateful winter of 1919-20, the seeds that came to such strange and terrible fruition. Dr. Willett is certain that up to this ill-omened winter of first change, Charles Ward's antiquarianism was free from every trace of the morbid. Graveyards held for him no particular attraction beyond their quaintness and historic value, and of anything like violence or savage instinct he was utterly devoid. Then, by insidious degrees, there appeared to develop a curious sequel to one of his genealogical triumphs of the year before, when he had discovered among his maternal ancestors a certain very long-lived man named Joseph Kirwin, who had come from Salem in March of 1692, and about whom a whispered series of highly peculiar and disquieting stories clustered. Ward's great-great-grandfather, Welcome Potter, had in 1785 married a certain Anne Tillinghast, daughter to Mrs. Eliza, daughter to Captain James Tillinghast, of whose paternity the family had preserved no trace. Late in 1918, whilst examining a volume of original town records and manuscript, the young genealogist encountered an entry describing a legal change of name, by which, in 1772, a Mrs. Eliza Kirwin, widow of Joseph Kirwin, resumed, along with her 7-year-old daughter Anne, her maiden name of Tillinghast, on the ground that her husband's name was become a public reproach by reason of what was known after his decease, the which, confirming an ancient common rumor, though not to be credited by a loyal wife, till so proven as to be wholly past doubting. This entry came to light upon the accidental separation of 2 leaves which had been carefully pasted together and treated as one by a labored revision of the page numbers. It was at once clear to Charles Ward that he had indeed discovered a hitherto unknown great-great-great-grandfather. The discovery doubly excited him, because he had already heard vague reports and seen scattered allusions relating to this person about whom there remained so few publicly available records, aside from those becoming public only in modern times, that it almost seemed as if a conspiracy had existed to blot him from memory. What did appear, moreover, was of such singular and provocative nature that one could not fail to imagine curiously what it was the colonial recorders were so anxious to conceal and forget, or to suspect that the deletion had reasons all too valid. Before this, Ward had been content to let his romancing about old Joseph Kirwin remain in the idle stage, but having discovered his own relationship to this apparently hushed-up character, he proceeded to hunt out as systematically as possible whatever he might find concerning him. In this excited quest, he eventually succeeded beyond his highest expectations, for old letters, diaries, and sheaves of unpublished memoirs in cobwebbed Providence garrets and elsewhere yielded many illuminating passages which their writers had not thought it worthwhile to destroy. One important sidelight came from a point as remote as New York, where some Rhode Island colonial correspondence was stored in the museum at Francis's Tavern. The really crucial thing, though, and what in Dr. Willett's opinion formed the definite source of Ward's undoing, was the matter found in August 1919, behind the paneling of the crumbling house in Olney Court. It was that, beyond a doubt, which opened up those black vistas whose end was deeper than the pit. Chapter 2. An Antecedent and a Horror. Joseph Kirwin, as revealed by the rambling legends embodied in what Ward heard and unearthed, was a very astonishing, enigmatic, obscurely horrible individual. He had fled from Salem to Providence, that universal haven of the odd, the free, and the dissenting, at the beginning of the great witchcraft panic, being in fear of accusation because of his solitary ways and queer chemical or alchemical experiments. He was a colorless-looking man of about 30, and was soon found qualified to become a freeman in Providence, thereafter buying a home lot just north of Gregory Dexter's, at about the foot of Olney Street. His house was built on Stamper's Hill, west of the town street, in what later became Olney Court, and in 1761 he replaced this with a larger one on the same site, which is still standing. Now, the first odd thing about Joseph Kirwin was that he did not seem to grow much older than he had been on his arrival. He engaged in shipping enterprises, purchased wharfage near Mile End Cove, helped rebuild the Great Bridge in 1713 and the Congregational Church on the hill. But always did he retain the nondescript aspect of a man not greatly over 30 or 35. As decades mounted up, this singular quality began to excite wide notice. But Kirwin always explained it by saying that he came of hardy forefathers and practiced a simplicity of living which did not wear him out. How such simplicity could be reconciled with the inexplicable comings and goings of the secretive merchant, and with the queer gleamings of his windows at all hours of night, was not very clear to the townsfolk, and they were prone to assign other reasons for his continued youth and longevity. It was held, for the most part, that Kirwin's incessant mixings and boilings of chemicals had much to do with his condition. Gossip spoke of the strange substances he brought from London and the Indies on his ships, or purchased in Newport, Boston, and New York. And when old Dr. Jabez Bowen came from Rehoboth and opened his apothecary shop across the Great Bridge at the sign of the Unicorn and Mortar, There was ceaseless talk of the drugs, acids, and metals that the taciturn recluse incessantly bought or ordered from him. Acting on the assumption that Kerwin possessed a wondrous and secret medical skill, many sufferers of various sorts applied to him for aid. But though he appeared to encourage their belief in a non-committal way, and always gave them odd-colored potions in response to their requests, it was observed that his ministrations to others seldom proved of benefit. At length, when over 50 years had passed since the stranger's advent, and without producing more than 5 years' apparent change in his face and physique, the people began to whisper more darkly, and to meet more than halfway that desire for isolation which he had always shown. Private letters and diaries of the period revealed, too, a multitude of other reasons why Joseph Kerwin was marveled at, feared, and finally shunned like a plague. His passion for graveyards, in which he was glimpsed at all hours and under all conditions, was notorious. Though no one had witnessed any deed on his part which could actually be termed ghoulish, on the Pawtuxet Road he had a farm, at which he generally lived during the summer, and to which he would frequently be seen riding at various odd times of the day or night. Here his only visible servants, farmers, and caretakers were a sullen pair of Narragansett Indians, the husband dumb and curiously scarred, and the wife of a very repulsive cast of countenance, probably due to a mixture of Negro blood. In the lean-to of this house was the laboratory where most of the chemical experiments were conducted. Curious porters and teamers who delivered bottles, bags, or boxes at the small rear doors would exchange accounts of the fantastic flasks, crucibles, alembics, and furnaces they saw in the low-shelved room, and prophesied in whispers that the close-mouthed chemist, by which they meant alchemist, would not be long in finding the philosopher's stone. The nearest neighbors to this farm, the Fenners, a quarter of a mile away, had still queerer things to tell of certain sounds which they insisted came from the Kerwin place in the night. There were cries, they said, and sustained howlings, and they did not like the large number of livestock which thronged the pastures, for no such amount was needed to keep a lone old man and a very few servants in meat, milk, and wool. The identity of the stock seemed to change from week to week, as new droves were purchased from the Kingstown farmers. Then, too, there was something very obnoxious about a certain great stone outbuilding with only high, narrow slits for windows. Great Bridge idlers had much to say of Kerwin's townhouse in Olney Court. Not so much the fine new one built in 1761, when the man must have been nearly a century old, but the first, low, gambrel-roofed one, with the windowless attic and shingled sides, whose timbers he took the peculiar precaution of burning after its demolition. Here there was less mystery, it is true, but the hours at which lights were seen, the secretiveness of the two swarthy foreigners who comprised the only men-servants, the hideous, indistinct mumbling of the incredibly aged French housekeeper, the large amounts of food seen to enter a door within which only 4 persons lived, and the quality of certain voices often heard in muffled conversation at highly unseasonable times, all combined with what was known of the Pawtuxet farm to give the place a bad name. In choicer circles, too, the Kerwin home was by no means undiscussed, for as the newcomer had gradually worked into the church and trading life of the town, he had naturally made acquaintances of the better sort, whose company and conversation he was well fitted to enjoy. His birth was known to be good, since the Kerwins, or Carwins, of Salem needed no introduction in New England. It developed that Joseph Kerwin had traveled much in very early life, living for a time in England and making at least 2 voyages to the Orient. And his speech, when he deigned to use it, was that of a learned and cultivated Englishman. But for some reason or other, Kerwin did not care for society. Whilst never actually rebuffing a visitor, he always reared such a wall of reserve that few could think of anything to say to him which would not sound inane. There seemed a lurk in his bearing, some cryptic, sardonic arrogance, as if he had come to find all human beings dull through having moved among stranger and more potent entities. When Dr. Checkley, the famous wit, came from Boston in 1738 to be rector of King's Church, he did not neglect calling on one of whom he had heard so much, but left in a very short while, because of some sinister undercurrent he detected in his host's discourse. Charles Ward told his father, when they discussed Kirwan one winter evening, that he would give much to learn what the mysterious old man had said to the sprightly cleric, but that all diarists agree concerning Dr. Checkley's reluctance to repeat anything he had heard. The good man had been hideously shocked, and could never recall Joseph Kirwan without a visible loss of the gay urbanity for which he was famed. More definite, however, was the reason why another man of taste and breeding avoided the haughty hermit. In 1746, Mr. John Merritt, an elderly English gentleman of literary and scientific leanings, came from Newport to the town which was so rapidly overtaking it in standing, and built a fine country seat on the neck in what is now the heart of the best residence section. He lived in considerable style and comfort, keeping the first coach and liveried servants in town, and taking great pride in his telescope, his microscope, and his well-chosen library of English and Latin books. Hearing of Kirwan as the owner of the best library in Providence, Mr. Merritt early paid him a call, and was more cordially received than most other callers at the house had been. His admiration for his host's ample shelves, which, besides the Greek, Latin, and English classics, were equipped with a remarkable battery of philosophical, mathematical, and scientific works, including Paracelsus, Agricola, von Helmont, Sylvius, Glauber, Boyle, Boerhaave, Becher, and Stahl, led Kirwan to suggest a visit to the farmhouse and laboratory, whither he had never invited anyone before. And the two drove out at once in Mr. Merritt's coach. Mr. Merritt always confessed to seeing nothing really horrible at the farmhouse, but maintained that the titles of the books in the special library of thaumaturgical, alchemical, and theological subjects, which Kirwan kept in a front room, were alone sufficient to inspire him with a lasting loathing. Perhaps, however, the facial expression of the owner in exhibiting them contributed much of the prejudice. This bizarre collection, besides a host of standard works which Mr. Merritt was not too alarmed to envy, embraced nearly all the cabalists, demonologists, and magicians known to man, and was a treasure house of lore in the doubtful realms of alchemy and astrology. Hermes Trismegistus in Mesnard's edition, the Turba Philosopharum, Geber's Liber Investigationis, and Artifice's Key of Wisdom, all were there, with the cabalistic Zohar, Peter Jahn's set of Albertus Magnus, Raymond Lully's Ars Magna et Ultima in Setzner's edition, Roger Bacon's Thesaurus Chemicus, Flood's Clavis Alchemii, Trithemius's De Lapide Philosophico, crowding them close. Medieval Jews and Arabs were represented in profusion, and Mr. Merritt turned pale when, upon taking down a fine volume conspicuously labeled as the Quanun e Islam, he found it was in truth the forbidden Necronomicon of the mad Arab Abdul al-Hazred, of which he had heard such monstrous things whispered some years previously, after the exposure of nameless rites at the strange little fishing village of Kingsport, in the province of the Massachusetts Bay. But, oddly enough, the worthy gentleman owned himself most impalpably disquieted by a mere minor detail. On the huge mahogany table there lay face downward a badly worn copy of Borellus, bearing many cryptical marginalia and interlineations in Kirwan's hand. The book was open to about its middle, and one paragraph displayed such thick and tremulous pen strokes beneath the lines of mystic black letters that the visitor could not resist scanning it through. Whether it was the nature of the passage underscored, or the feverish heaviness of the strokes which formed the underscoring, he could not tell. But something in that combination affected him very badly and very peculiarly. He recalled it to the end of his days, writing it down from memory in his diary, and once trying to recite it to his close friend, Dr. Checkley, till he saw how greatly it disturbed the urbane rector. It read, "The essential salts of animals may be so prepared and preserved that an ingenious man may have the whole Ark of Noah in his own study, and raise the fine shape of an animal out of its ashes at his pleasure, and by the like method from the essential salts of human dust, a philosopher may, without any criminal necromancy, call up the shape of any dead ancestor from the dust whereinto his body has been incinerated." It was near the docks along the southerly part of the town street, however, that the worst things were muttered about Joseph Kerwin. Sailors are superstitious folk, and the seasoned salts who manned the infinite rum, slaves, and molasses sloops, the rakish privateers and the great brigs of the Browns, Crawfords, and Tillinghasts, all made strange furtive signs of protection when they saw the slim, deceptively young-looking figure, with its yellow hair and slight stoop, entering the Kerwin warehouse in Doubloon Street, or talking with captains and supercargoes on the long quay where the Kerwin ships rode restlessly. Kerwin's own clerks and captains hated and feared him, and all his sailors were mongrel riffraff from Martinique, St. Eustatius, Havana, or Port Royal. It was, in a way, the frequency with which these sailors were replaced which inspired the acutest and most tangible part of the fear in which the old man was held. A crew would be turned loose in the town on shore leave, some of its members perhaps charged with this errand or that, and when reassembled it would be almost sure to lack one or more men. That many of the errands had concerned the farm on the Pawtuxet Road, and that few of the sailors had ever been seen to return from that place, was not forgotten. So that in time it became exceedingly difficult for Kerwin to keep his oddly assorted hands. Almost invariably several would desert soon after hearing the gossip of the Providence wharves, and their replacement in the West Indies became an increasingly great problem to the merchant. By 1760, Joseph Kerwin was virtually an outcast, suspected of vague horrors and demoniac alliances, which seemed all the more menacing because they could not be named, understood, or even proved to exist. The last straw may have come from the affair of the missing soldiers in 1758, for in March and April of that year, two royal regiments on their way to New France were quartered in Providence, and depleted by an inexplicable process far beyond the average rate of desertion. Rumor dwelt on the frequency with which Kerwin was wont to be seen talking with the red-coated strangers, and as several of them began to be missed, people thought of the odd conditions among his own seamen. What would have happened if the regiments had not been ordered on, no one can tell. Meanwhile, the merchant's worldly affairs were prospering. He had a virtual monopoly of the town's trade in saltpeter, black pepper, and cinnamon, and easily led any other one shipping establishment, save the Browns, in his importation of brassware, indigo, cotton, woolens, salt, rigging, iron, paper, and English goods of every kind. Such shopkeepers as James Green at the sign of the Elephant in Cheapside, the Russells at the sign of the Golden Eagle across the bridge, or Clark and Nightingale at the Frying Pan and Fish near the new coffee house, depended almost wholly upon him for their stock, and his arrangements with the local distillers, the Narragansett dairymen and horse breeders, and the Newport candle makers, made him one of the prime exporters of the colony. Ostracized though he was, he did not lack for civic spirit of a sort. When the colony house burned down, he subscribed handsomely to the lotteries by which the new brick one, still standing at the head of its parade in the old main street, was built in 1761. In that same year, too, he helped rebuild the Great Bridge after the October gale. He replaced many of the books of the public library consumed in the colony house fire, and bought heavily in the lottery that gave the muddy market parade and deep-rutted town street their pavement of great round stones with a footwalk or a causey in the middle. About this time also he built the plain but excellent new house whose doorway is such a triumph of carving. When the Whitefield adherents broke off from Dr. Cotton's Hill Church in 1743 and founded Deacon Snow's church across the bridge, Kirwan had gone with them, though his zeal and attendance soon abated. Now, however, he cultivated piety once more, as if to dispel the shadow which had thrown him into isolation, and would soon begin to wreck his business fortunes if not sharply checked. The sight of this strange, pallid man, hardly middle-aged in aspect, yet certainly not less than a full century old, seeking at last to emerge from a cloud of fright and detestation too vague to pin down or analyze, was at once a pathetic, a dramatic, and a contemptible thing. Such is the power of wealth and of surface gestures, however, that there came indeed a slight abatement in the visible aversion displayed toward him, especially after the rapid disappearances of his sailors abruptly ceased. He must likewise have begun to practice an extreme care and secrecy in his graveyard expeditions, for he was never again caught at such wanderings, whilst the rumors of uncanny sounds and maneuvers at his Pawtuxet farm diminished in proportion. His rate of food consumption and cattle replacement remained abnormally high, but not until modern times, when Charles Ward examined a set of his accounts and invoices in the Shepley Library, did it occur to any person, save one embittered youth, perhaps, to make dark comparisons between the large number of guinea blacks he imported until 1766 and the disturbingly small number for whom he could produce bona fide bills of sale either to slave dealers at the Great Bridge or to the planters of the Narragansett country. Certainly the cunning and ingenuity of this abhorred character were uncannily profound, once the necessity for their exercise had become impressed upon him. But of course the effect of all this belated mending was necessarily slight. Kirwan continued to be avoided and distrusted, as indeed the one fact of his continued air of youth at a great age would have been enough to warrant, and he could see that in the end his fortunes would be likely to suffer. His elaborate studies and experiments, whatever they may have been, apparently required a heavy income for their maintenance. And since a change of environment would deprive him of the trading advantages he had gained, it would not have profited him to begin anew in a different region just then. Judgment demanded that he patch up his relations with the townsfolk of Providence, so that his presence might no longer be a signal for hushed conversation, transparent excuses of errands elsewhere, and a general atmosphere of restraint and uneasiness. His clerks, being now reduced to the shiftless and impecunious residue whom no one else would employ, were giving him much worry, and he held to his sea captains and mates only by shrewdness in gaining some kind of ascendancy over them, a mortgage, a promissory note, or a bit of information very pertinent to their welfare. In many cases, diarists have recorded with some awe, Kirwan showed almost the power of a wizard in unearthing family secrets for questionable use. During the final 5 years of his life, it seemed as though only direct talks with the long dead could possibly have furnished some of the data which he had so glibly at his tongue's end. About this time, the crafty scholar hit upon a last desperate expedient to regain his footing in the community. Hitherto a complete hermit, he now determined to contract an advantageous marriage, securing as a bride some lady whose mentioned position would make all ostracism of his home impossible. It may be that he also had deeper reasons for wishing an alliance, wishing so far outside the known cosmic sphere that only papers found a century and a half after his death caused anyone to suspect them. But of this nothing certain can ever be learned. Naturally, he was aware of the horror and indignation with which any ordinary courtship of his would be received. Hence, he looked about for some likely candidate upon whose parents he might exert a suitable pressure. Such candidates, he found, were not at all easy to discover, since he had very particular requirements in the way of beauty, accomplishments, and social security. At length, his survey narrowed down to the household of one of his best and oldest ship captains, a widower of high birth and unblemished standing, named Duty Tillinghast, whose only daughter, Eliza, seemed dowered with every conceivable advantage, save prospects as an heiress.
Captain Tillinghast was completely under the domination of Kerwin, and consented, after a terrible interview in his cupolaed house on Powers Lane Hill, to sanction the blasphemous alliance. Eliza Tillinghast was at that time 18 years of age, and had been reared as gently as the reduced circumstances of her father permitted. She had attended Stephen Jackson's school, opposite the courthouse parade, and had been diligently instructed by her mother before the latter's death of smallpox in 1757 in all the arts and refinements of domestic life. A sampler of hers, worked in 1753 at the age of 9, may still be found in the rooms of the Rhode Island Historical Society. After her mother's death, she had kept the house, aided only by one old black woman. Her arguments with her father concerning the proposed Kerwin marriage must have been painful indeed, but of these we have no record. Certain it is that her engagement to young Ezra Whedon, second mate of the Crawford Packet Enterprise, was dutifully broken off, and that her union with Joseph Kerwin took place on the 7th of March, 1763, in the Baptist Church, in the presence of one of the most distinguished assemblages which the town could boast, the ceremony being performed by the younger Samuel Winson. The Gazette mentioned the event very briefly, and in most surviving copies the item in question seems to be cut or torn out. Ward found a single intact copy, after much search, in the archives of a private collector of note, observing with amusement the meaningless urbanity of the language. Monday evening last, Mr. Joseph Kerwin of this town, merchant, was married to Miss Eliza Tillinghast, daughter of Captain Duty Tillinghast, a young lady who has real merit, added to a beautiful person, to grace the connubial state and perpetuate its felicity. The collection of Durfee Arnold letters, discovered by Charles Ward shortly before his first reputed madness, in the private collection of Melville F. Peters of George Street, and covering this and a somewhat antecedent period, throws vivid light on the outrage done to public sentiment by this ill-assorted match. The social influence of the Tillinghasts, however, was not to be denied, and once more Joseph Kerwin found his house frequented by persons whom he could never otherwise have induced to cross his threshold. His acceptance was by no means complete, and his bride was socially the sufferer through her forced venture, but at all events the fall of utter ostracism was somewhat worn down. In his treatment of his wife, the strange bridegroom astonished both her and the community by displaying an extreme graciousness and consideration. The new house in Olney Court was now wholly free from disturbing manifestations, and although Kerwin was much absent at the Pawtuxet farm, which his wife never visited, he seemed more like a normal citizen than at any other time in his long years of residence. Only one person remained in open enmity with him, this being the youthful ship's officer, whose engagement to Eliza Tillinghast had been so abruptly broken. Ezra Whedon had frankly vowed vengeance, and though of a quiet and ordinarily mild disposition, was now gaining a hatred-dogged purpose, which boded no good to the usurping husband. On the 7th of May, 1765, Kerwin's only child, Anne, was born, and was christened by the Reverend John Graves of King's Church, of which both husband and wife had become communicants shortly after their marriage, in order to compromise between their respective Congregational and Baptist affiliations. The record of this birth, as well as that of the marriage 2 years before, was stricken from most copies of the church and town annals, where it ought to appear, and Charles Ward located both with the greatest difficulty after his discovery of the widow's change of name had apprised him of his own relationship, and engendered the feverish interest which culminated in his madness. The birth entry, indeed, was found very curiously through correspondence with the heirs of the loyalist Dr. Graves, who had taken with him a duplicate set of records when he left his pastorate at the outbreak of the Revolution. Ward had tried this source because he knew that his great-great-grandmother, Anne Tillinghast Potter, had been an Episcopalian. Shortly after the birth of his daughter, an event he seemed to welcome with a fervor greatly out of keeping with his usual coldness, Kerwin resolved to sit for a portrait. This he had painted by a very gifted Scotsman named Cosmo Alexander, then a resident of Newport, and since famous as the early teacher of Gilbert Stuart. The likeness was said to have been executed on a wall panel of the library of the house in Olney Court, but neither of the two old diaries mentioning it gave any hint of its ultimate disposition. At this period, the erratic scholar showed signs of unusual abstraction, and spent as much time as he possibly could at his farm on the Pawtuxet Road. He seemed, it was stated, in a condition of suppressed excitement or suspense, as if expecting some phenomenal thing, or on the brink of some strange discovery. Chemistry or alchemy would appear to have played a great part, for he took from his house to the farm the greater number of his volumes on that subject. His affectation of civic interest did not diminish, and he lost no opportunities for helping such leaders as Stephen Hopkins, Joseph Brown, and Benjamin West in their efforts to raise the cultural tone of the town, which was then much below the level of Newport in its patronage of the liberal arts. He had helped Daniel Jenks found his bookshop in 1763, and was thereafter his best customer, extending aid likewise to the struggling Gazette that appeared each Wednesday at the sign of Shakespeare's Head. In politics, he ardently supported Governor Hopkins against the Ward Party, whose prime strength was in Newport, and his really eloquent speech at Hatcher's Hall in 1765 against the setting off of North Providence as a separate town, with a pre-Ward vote in the General Assembly, did more than any other one thing to wear down the prejudice against him. But Ezra Whedon, who watched him closely, sneered cynically at all this outward activity, and freely swore it was no more than a mask for some nameless traffic with the blackest gulfs of Tartarus. The revengeful youth began a systematic study of the man, and his doings, whenever he was in port, spending hours at night by the wharves with a dory in readiness when he saw lights in the Kerwin warehouses, and following the small boat which would sometimes steal quietly off and down the bay. He also kept as close a watch as possible on the Pawtuxet farm, and was once severely bitten by the dogs the old Indian couple loosed upon him. By the autumn of 1770, Whedon decided that the time was very sudden, and gained a wide notice amongst the curious townsfolk. For the air of suspense and expectancy dropped like an old cloak, giving instant place to an ill-concealed exaltation of perfect triumph. Kerwin seemed to have difficulty in restraining himself from public harangues on what he had found or learned or made, but apparently the need of secrecy was greater than the longing to share his rejoicing, for no explanation was ever offered by him. It was after this transition, which appears to have come early in July, that the sinister scholar began to astonish people by his possession of information which only their long-dead ancestors would seem to be able to impart. But Kerwin's feverish secret activities by no means ceased with this change. On the contrary, they tended rather to increase, so that more and more of his shipping business was handled by the captains whom he now bound to him by ties of fear as potent as those of bankruptcy had been. He altogether abandoned the slave trade, alleging that its profits were constantly decreasing. Every possible moment was spent at the Pawtuxet farm, though there were rumors now and then of his presence in places which, though not actually near graveyards, were yet so situated in relation to graveyards that thoughtful people wondered just how thorough the old merchant's change of habits really was. Ezra Whedon, though his periods of espionage were necessarily brief and intermittent on account of his sea voyaging, had a vindictive persistence which the bulk of the practical townsfolk and farmers lacked, and subjected Kerwin's affairs to a scrutiny such as they had never had before. Many of the odd maneuvers of the strange merchant's vessels had been taken for granted on account of the unrest of the times, when every colonist seemed determined to resist the provisions of the Sugar Act, which hampered a prominent traffic. Smuggling and evasion were the rule in Narragansett Bay, and nocturnal landings of illicit cargoes were continuous commonplaces. But Whedon, night after night, following the lighters or small sloops which he saw steal off from the Kerwin warehouses at the Town Street docks, soon felt assured that it was not merely His Majesty's armed ships which the sinister skulker was anxious to avoid. Prior to the change in 1766, these boats had for the most part contained chained Negroes, who were carried down and across the bay and landed at an obscure point on the shore just north of Pawtuxet, being afterward driven up the bluff and across country to the Kerwin farm, where they were locked in that enormous stone outbuilding which had only high, narrow slits for windows. After that change, however, the whole program was altered. Importation of slaves ceased at once, and for a time Kerwin abandoned his midnight sailings. Then, about the spring of 1767, a new policy appeared. Once more the lighters grew wont to put out from the black silent docks, and this time they would go down the bay some distance, perhaps as far as Nanquit Point, where they would meet and receive cargo from strange ships of considerable size and widely varied appearance. Kerwin's sailors would then deposit this cargo at the usual point on the shore and transport it overland to the farm, locking it in the same cryptical stone building which had formerly received the Negroes. The cargo consisted almost wholly of boxes and cases, of which a large proportion were oblong and heavy, and disturbingly suggestive of coffins. Whedon always watched the farm with unremitting assiduity, visiting it each night for long periods, and seldom letting a week go by without a sight, except when the ground bore a footprint revealing snow. Even then he would often walk as close as possible in the traveled road, or on the ice of the neighboring river, to see what tracks others might have left. Finding his own vigils interrupted by nautical duties, he hired a tavern companion named Eleazar Smith to continue the survey during his absences, and between them the two could have set in motion some extraordinary rumors. That they did not do so was only because they knew the effect of publicity would be to warn their quarry and make further progress impossible. Instead, they wished to learn something definite before taking any action. What they did learn must have been startling indeed, and Charles Ward spoke many times to his parents of his regret at Whedon's later burning of his notebooks. All that can be told of their discoveries is what Eleazar Smith jotted down in a none-too-coherent diary, and what other diarists and letter-writers have timidly repeated from the statements which they finally made, and according to which the farm was only the outer shell of some vast and revolting menace, of a scope and depth too profound and intangible for more than shadowy comprehension. It is gathered that Whedon and Smith became early convinced that a great series of tunnels and catacombs, inhabited by a very sizable staff of persons besides the old Indian and his wife, underlay the farm. The house was an old peaked relic of the middle 17th century, with enormous stacked chimney and diamond-paned lattice windows, the laboratory being in a lean-to toward the north, where the roof came nearly to the ground. This building stood clear of any other. Yet, judging by the different voices heard at odd times within, it must have been accessible through secret passages beneath. These voices, before 1766, were mere mumblings and Negro whisperings and frenzied screams, coupled with curious chants or invocations. After that date, however, they assumed a very singular and terrible cast, as they ran the gamut betwixt dronings of dull acquiescence and explosions of frantic fury, rumblings of conversation and whines of entreaty, pantings of eagerness, and shouts of protest. They appeared to be in different languages, all known to Kerwin, whose rasping accents were frequently distinguishable in reply, reproof, or threatening. Sometimes it seemed that several persons must be in the house. Kerwin, certain captives, and the guards of those captives. There were voices of a sort that neither Whedon nor Smith had ever heard before, despite their wide knowledge of foreign ports. and many that they did seem to place as belonging to this or that nationality. The nature of the conversations seemed always a kind of catechism, as if Kerwin were extorting some sort of information from terrified or rebellious prisoners. Whedon had many verbatim reports of overheard scraps in his notebook, for English, French, and Spanish, which he knew, were frequently used. But of these, nothing has survived. He did, however, say that besides a few ghoulish dialogues in which the past affairs of Providence families were concerned, most of the questions and answers he could understand were historical or scientific, occasionally pertaining to very remote places and ages. Once, for example, an alternately raging and sullen figure was questioned in French about the Black Prince's massacre at Limoges in 1370, as if there were some hidden reason which he ought to know. Kerwin asked the prisoner, if prisoner it were, whether the order to slay was given because of the sign of the goat found on the altar in the ancient Roman crypt beneath the cathedral, or whether the dark man of the Haute-Vienne coven had spoke the three words. Failing to obtain replies, the inquisitor had seemingly resorted to extreme means, for there was a terrific shriek, followed by silence and muttering and a bumping sound. None of these colloquies was ever ocularly witnessed, since the windows were always heavily draped. Once, though, during a discourse in an unknown tongue, a shadow was seen on the curtain, which startled Whedon exceedingly, reminding him of one of the puppets in a show he had seen in the autumn of 1764 in Hatcher's Hall, when a man from Germantown, Pennsylvania, had given a clever mechanical spectacle advertised as a view of the famous city of Jerusalem, in which are represented Jerusalem, the Temple of Solomon, his royal throne, the noted towers and hills, likewise the sufferings of our Savior from the Garden of Gethsemane to the cross on the hill of Golgotha, an artful piece of statuary worthy to be seen by the curious. It was on this occasion that the listener, who had crept close to the window of the front room whence the speaking proceeded, gave a start which roused the old Indian pair and caused them to loose the dogs on him. After that, no more conversations were ever heard in the house, and Whedon and Smith concluded that Kerwin had transferred his field of action to regions below. That such regions in truth existed seemed amply clear from many things. Faint cries and groans unmistakably came up now and then from what appeared to be the solid earth in places far from any structure, whilst hidden in the bushes along the riverbank in the rear, where the high ground sloped steeply down to the valley of the Patuxent, there was found an arched oaken door in a frame of heavy masonry, which was obviously an entrance to caverns within the hill. When or how these catacombs could have been constructed, Whedon was unable to say, but he frequently pointed out how easily the place might have been reached by bands of unseen workmen from the river. Joseph Kerwin put his mongrel seamen to diverse uses indeed. During the heavy spring rains of 1769, the two watchers kept a sharp eye on the steep river bank to see if any subterranean secrets might be washed to light, and were rewarded by the sight of a profusion of both human and animal bones in places where deep gullies had been worn in the banks. Naturally, there might be many explanations of such things in the rear of a stock farm, and in a locality where old Indian burying grounds were common, but Whedon and Smith drew their own inferences. It was in January 1770, whilst Whedon and Smith were still debating vainly on what, if anything, to think or do about the whole bewildering business, that the incident of the Fortaleza occurred. Exasperated by the burning of the revenue sloop Liberty at Newport during the previous summer, the custom fleet under Admiral Wallace had adopted an increased vigilance concerning strange vessels, and on this occasion His Majesty's armed schooner Signet, under Captain Harry Lesh, captured, after a short pursuit, one early morning, the scow Fortaleza of Barcelona, Spain, under Captain Manuel Arruda, bound, according to its log, from Grand Cairo, Egypt, to Providence. When searched for contraband material, this ship revealed the astonishing fact that its cargo consisted exclusively of Egyptian mummies, consigned to Sailor A, B, C, who would come to remove his goods in a lighter just off Nanquit Point, and whose identity, Captain Aruda, felt himself in honor bound not to reveal. The Vice Admiral Court at Newport, at a loss what to do in view of the non-contraband nature of the cargo, on the one hand, and of the unlawful secrecy of the entry, on the other hand, compromised on Collector Robinson's recommendation by freeing the ship, but forbidding it a port in Rhode Island waters. There were later rumors of its having been seen in Boston Harbor, though it never openly entered the port of Boston. This extraordinary incident did not fail of wide remark in Providence, and there were not many who doubted the existence of some connection between the cargo of mummies and the sinister Joseph Kerwin. His exotic studies and his curious chemical importations being common knowledge, and his fondness for graveyards being common suspicion, it did not take much imagination to link him with a freakish importation which could not conceivably have been destined for anyone else in the town. As if conscious of this natural belief, Kerwin took care to speak casually on several occasions of the chemical value of the balsams found in mummies, thinking, perhaps, that he might make the affair seem less unnatural, yet stopping just short of admitting his participation. Whedon and Smith, of course, felt no doubt whatsoever of the significance of the thing, and indulged in the wildest theories concerning Kerwin and his monstrous labors. The following spring, like that of the year before, had heavy rains, and the watchers kept careful track of the riverbank behind the Kerwin farm. Large sections were washed away, and a certain number of bones discovered, but no glimpse was afforded of any actual subterranean chambers or burrows. Something was rumored, however, at the village of Pawtuxet, about a mile below, where the river flows and falls over a rocky terrace to join the placid landlocked cover. There, where quaint old cottages climbed the hill from the rustic bridge, and fishing smacks lay anchored at their sleepy docks, a vague report went round of things that were floating down the river, and flashing into sight for a minute as they went over the falls. Of course, the Pawtuxet is a long river, which winds through many settled regions abounding in graveyards, and, of course, the spring rains had been very heavy. But the fisherfolk about the bridge did not like the wild way that one of the things stared as it shot down to the still water below, or the way that another half cried out, although its condition had greatly departed from that of objects which normally cry out. That rumor sent Smith, for Whedon was just then at sea, in haste to the riverbank behind the farm, where surely enough there remained the evidences of an extensive cave-in. There was, however, no trace of a passage into the steep bank, for the miniature avalanche had left behind a solid wall of mixed earth and shrubbery from aloft. Smith went to the extent of some experimental digging, but was deterred by lack of success, or perhaps by fear of possible success. It is interesting to speculate on what the persistent and revengeful Whedon would have done had he been ashore at the time. By the autumn of 1770, Whedon decided that the time was ripe to tell others of his discoveries, for he had a large number of facts to link together, and a second eyewitness to refute the possible charge that jealousy and vindictiveness had spurred his fancy. As his first confidant, he selected Captain James Mathewson, of the Enterprise, who on the one hand knew him well enough not to doubt his veracity, and on the other hand was sufficiently influential in the town to be heard in turn with respect. The colloquy took place in an upper room of Sabin's Tavern near the docks, with Smith present to corroborate virtually every statement, and it could be seen that Captain Mathewson was tremendously impressed. Like nearly everyone else in the town, he had had black suspicions of his own anent Joseph Kerwin. Hence it needed only this confirmation and enlargement of data to convince him absolutely. At the end of the conference he was very grave, and enjoined strict silence upon the two younger men. He would, he said, transmit the information separately to some 10 or so of the most learned and prominent citizens of Providence, ascertaining their views and following whatever advice they might have to offer. Secrecy would probably be essential in any case, for this was no matter that the town constables or militia could cope with. And above all else, the excitable crowd must be kept in ignorance, lest there be enacted in these already troublous times a repetition of that frightful Salem panic of less than a century before, which had first brought Kerwin hither. The right persons to tell, he believed, would be Dr. Benjamin West, whose pamphlet on the late transit of Venus proved him a scholar and keen thinker, Reverend James Manning, president of the college which had just moved up from Warren and was temporarily housed in the new King Street schoolhouse, awaiting the completion of its building on the hill above Presbyterian Lane, ex-Governor Stephen Hopkins, who had been a member of the Philosophical Society at Newport, and was a man of very broad perceptions, John Carter, publisher of the Gazette. All four of the Brown brothers, John, Joseph, Nicholas, and Moses, who formed the recognized local magnates, and of whom Joseph was an amateur scientist of parts, old Dr. Jabez Bowen, whose erudition was considerable, and who had much first-hand knowledge of Kerwin's odd purchases, and Captain Abraham Whipple, a privateersman of phenomenal boldness and energy, who could be counted on to lead in any active measures needed. These men, if favorable, might eventually be brought together for collective deliberation, and with them would rest the responsibility of deciding whether or not to inform the governor of the colony, Joseph Wanton of Newport, before taking action. The mission of Captain Mathewson prospered beyond his highest expectations, for whilst he found one or two of the chosen confidants somewhat skeptical of the possible ghostly side of Whedon's tale, there was not one who did not think it necessary to take some sort of secret and coordinated action. Kerwin, it was clear, formed a vague potential menace to the welfare of the town and colony, and must be eliminated at any cost. Late in December 1770, a group of eminent townsmen met at the home of Stephen Hopkins, and debated tentative measures. Whedon's notes, which he had given to Captain Mathewson, were carefully read, and he and Smith were summoned to give testimony anent details. Something very like fear seized the whole assemblage before the meeting was over, though there ran through that fear a grim determination which Captain Whipple's bluff and resonant profanity best expressed. They would not notify the governor, because a more than legal course seemed necessary. With hidden powers of uncertain extent apparently at his disposal, Kerwin was not a man who could safely be warned to leave town. Nameless reprisals might ensue, and even if the sinister creature complied, the removal would be no more than the shifting of an unclean burden to another place. The times were lawless, and the men who had flouted the king's revenue forces for years were not the ones to balk at sterner things when duty impelled. Kerwin must be surprised at his Pawtuxet farm by a large raiding party of seasoned privateersmen and given one decisive chance to explain himself. If he proved a madman, amusing himself with shrieked and imaginary conversations and different voices, he would be properly confined. If something graver appeared, and if the underground horrors indeed turned out to be real, he and all with him must die. It could be done quietly, and even the widow and her father need not be told how it came about. While these serious steps were under discussion, there occurred in the town an incident so terrible and inexplicable that for a time little else was mentioned for miles around. In the middle of a moonlight January night, with heavy snow underfoot, there resounded over the river and up the hill a shocking series of cries which brought sleepy heads to every window, and people around Weboset Point saw a great white thing plunging frantically along the badly cleared space in front of the Turk's Head. There was a baying of dogs in the distance, but this subsided as soon as the clamor of the awakened town became audible. Parties of men with lanterns and muskets hurried out to see what was happening, but nothing rewarded their search. The next morning, however, a giant, muscular body, stark naked, was found on the jams of ice around the southern piers of the Great Bridge, where the long dock stretched out beside Abbott's distill house, and the identity of this object became a theme for endless speculation and whispering. It was not so much the younger as the older folk who whispered, for only in the patriarchs did that rigid face with horror-bulging eyes strike any chord of memory. They, shaking as they did so, exchanged furtive murmurs of wonder and fear, for in those stiff, hideous features lay a resemblance so marvelous as to be almost an identity, and that identity was with a man who had died full 50 years before. Ezra Whedon was present at the finding, and remembering the baying of the night before, set out along Weybosset Street and across Muddy Dock Bridge, whence the sound had come. He had a curious expectancy, and was not surprised when, reaching the edge of the settled district, where the street merged into the Pawtuxet Road, he came upon some very curious tracks in the snow. The naked giant had been pursued by dogs and many booted men, and the returning tracks of the hounds and their masters could be easily traced. They had given up the chase upon coming too near the town. Whedon smiled grimly, and as a perfunctory detail traced the footprints back to their source. It was the Pawtuxet farm of Joseph Kerwin, as he well knew it would be, and he would have given much had the yard been less confusingly trampled. As it was, he dared not seem too interested in full daylight. Dr. Bowen, to whom Whedon went at once with his report, performed an autopsy on the strange corpse and discovered peculiarities which baffled him utterly. The digestive tracts of the huge man seemed never to have been in use, whilst the whole skin had a coarse, loosely knit texture impossible to account for. Impressed by what the old man whispered of this body's likeness to the long-dead blacksmith Daniel Green, whose great-grandson Aaron Hoppen was a supercargo in Kerwin's employ, Whedon asked casual questions till he found where Green was buried. That night a party of 10 visited the Old North Burying Ground, opposite Herndon's Lane, and opened a grave. They found it vacant, precisely as they had expected. Meanwhile, arrangements had been made with the post riders to intercept Joseph Kerwin's mail, and shortly before the incident of the naked body there was found a letter from one Jedediah Orne of Salem, which made the cooperating citizens think deeply. Parts of it, copied and preserved in the private archives of the family, where Charles Ward found it, ran as follows. I delight that you continue in ye getting at old matters in your way, and do not think better was done at Mr. Hutchinson's in Salem Village. Certainly there was nothing but ye liveliest awfulness in that which H. raised up from what we could gather only a part of. What you sent did not work, whether because anything missing, or because ye words were not right from my speaking, or your copying. Alone am at a loss. I have not ye chemical art to follow Borellus, and own myself confounded by ye seventh book of ye Necronomicon that ye recommend. But I would have you observe what was told to us about taking care whom to call up, for you are sensible what Mr. Mather writ in ye marginalia of blank, and can judge how truly that horrendous thing is reported. I say to you again, do not call up any that you cannot put down, by the which I mean any that can in turn call up somewhat against you, whereby your powerfulest devices may not be of use. Ask of the lesser, lest the greater shall not wish to answer, and shall command more than you. I was frighted when I read of your knowing what Ben Zarist Natmick had in his ebony box, for I was conscious who must have told you, and again I ask that you shall write me as Jedediah, and not Simon. In this community a man may not live too long, and you know my plan, by which I came back as my son, I am desirous you will acquaint me with what ye black men learnt from Silvanus Cassidius in ye vault under ye Roman wall, and will be obliged for ye lending of ye manuscript you speak of. Another and unsigned letter from Philadelphia provoked equal thought, especially for the following passage. I will observe what you say respecting the sending of accounts only by your vessels, but cannot always be certain when to expect them. In the matter spoke of, I require only one more thing, but wish to be sure I apprehend you exactly. You inform me that no part must be missing if the finest effects are to be had, but you cannot but know how hard it is to be sure. It seems a great hazard and burthen to take away the whole box, and in town, that is, St. Peter's, St. Paul's, St. Mary's, or Christ Church, it can scarce be done at all. But I know what imperfections were in the one raised up October last, and how many live specimens you were forced to employ before you hit upon the right mode in the year 1766. So will be guided by you in all matters. I am impatient for your brig, and inquire daily at Mr. Biddle's wharf. A third suspicious letter was in an unknown tongue and even an unknown alphabet. In the Smith Diary found by Charles Ward, a single oft-repeated combination of characters is clumsily copied, and authorities at Brown University have pronounced the alphabet Amharic or Abyssinian, although they do not recognize the word. None of these epistles was ever delivered to Kerwin, though the disappearance of Jedediah Orne from Salem, as recorded shortly afterward, showed that the Providence men took certain quiet steps. The Pennsylvania Historical Society also has some curious letter received by Dr. Shippen regarding the presence of an unwholesome character in Philadelphia. But more decisive steps were in the air, and it is in the secret assemblages of sworn and tested sailors and faithful old privateersmen in the brown warehouses by night that we must look for the main fruits of Whedon's disclosures. Slowly and surely a plan of campaign was under development which would leave no trace of Joseph Kerwin's noxious mysteries. Kerwin, despite all precautions, apparently felt that something was in the wind, for he was now remarked to wear an unusually worried look. His coach was seen at all hours in the town and on the Pawtuxet Road, and he dropped little by little the air of forced geniality with which he had latterly sought to combat the town's prejudice. End of side one. To continue, turn the cassette over.